Classical behavior is not a given in quantum mechanics. A quantum system behaves classically when its state and Hamiltonian imply that the probabilities for histories of the system, right, are correlated in time by deterministic laws. That's what we call classical behavior. That's true for as much for the flight of a tennis ball or for the motion of the Earth around the sun or for space-time geometry in a quantum theory of space-time. That means if classical space-time is a quantum phenomena, that classical histories of geometry and field will be limited only to patches in general of configuration space. You may not have classical behavior everywhere over the whole configuration space, or at least if you have it, you have to prove you have it. In a given patch, the states don't, in general, provide you with one classical space-time. They provide you with an ensemble of possibilities for space-time, classical space-time geometry, with probabilities for which one of them occurs. That's very true in cosmology, for example. In between the patches, to connect them, you've always got available quantum evolution, and typically one history will branch into many possible histories. The thesis of this talk is classical evolution can break down on scales that are much bigger than the Planck scale, that is, not the Planck scale, with no breakdown in the classical equations of motion. The calculation of the probabilities cannot give you space-time, but there's nothing especially that has to break down. That has some consequences, of which I'll just list a few. If classical space-time is available only in patches, then you're not, in general, going to be able to apply the global theorems of general relativity, which rely on a geodesically complete space-time. In particular, horizons, domains of dependence, singularity theorems, and so forth, that will, in general, no longer work. So it's a very strong assumption about the quantum state to assume that classical backgrounds can be extended to infinities. And in general, you're not just going to have classical evolution, but through foliating families of space-like surface when you don't have a classical space-time to define the space-like surface. The talk consists just of examples of this. I'm starting with the first one, which is not has nothing to do with space-time, but which is barrier penetration, which is very familiar. So a wave packet, spelling mistake, peaked around some definite position and momentum, scatters off a potential barrier. Here it is heading toward the barrier. Classical evolution, therefore, is predicted before it hits, right? And afterwards, it has branched into two wave packets, one going one way and one going the other. So you get classical evolution here, but not in the transition across the barrier. And one space-time has branched into two. Although, I should say that what this means, what you get on the other side, depends on the level of coarse graining at which you describe the system. Here, I'm thinking of the wave packets as described by classicality as described in a coarse graining that's roughly the width of the wave packets. But if you took a huge coarse graining, you know, that involved both of them, then you would have one classical space-time that evolves.
Did you just say one space-time branched into two?
I said one space-time, one wave packet branched into two. Oh. But coming up. Okay, this potentially has important impact for black holes. Because we expect classical space-time to exist certainly in asymptotic patches if we're in the asymptotic flat regime. We have a collapse, a bunch of matter coming down here, and then from scry minus, and then at scry plus, we have expect classical space-time with some outgoing, say, Hawking radiation going. But we expect many different final states, right, in this problem. For example, if we get down to a remnant, it could have exploded in different parts of the final spacetime. So there are many final asymptotic spacetimes for each initial one. And in principle, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation allows you a quantum mechanical way of making the transition between here and there. That quantum state remains pure. But it also means that if the classical spacetime is limited, there might not be enough spacetime to have a horizon defined as the boundary of the past to future null infinity. Here's future null infinity, but if you can't extrapolate the boundary because you don't have enough spacetime, you don't have a horizon. Therefore, the question of how much information can get out is changed by that. The information in the state is preserved, that's optimistic, but we don't have to have a mechanism that acts in spacetime to get the information out. I only have 20 minutes, so I'm going to give you four examples of this, ending with fuzzballs, which is the subject of today's talk. The first one is about bouncing spacetimes, right? That is where you have a recontraction, right, coming to a minimum radius in cosmology and then expanding out again. So to do this, I'm going to use a mini superspace model where the metric is just given by a scale factor b squared, and the geometries are closed, so this is the metric on this three-sphere. I'm taking the simplest form of the matter, which is a homogeneous scalar field moving in a quadratic potential m squared phi squared plus a cosmological constant. So the action is the usual Einstein action plus the action for the scalar field. For the state, I'll take Hawking's no boundary wave function, which in a semi-classical approximation is going to be given by saddle points of this action, which look like this. They only have one boundary, and they're closed off here. And in general, they're going to be complex. Oops, it's right there. Okay, so how does it predict classical spacetime? Well, I mentioned that so the action semi-classically, I mean the wave function semi-classically will be approximately given by e to the minus the action of that saddle point. The saddle point is in general complex, so there will be a real part to the saddle point action and a complex part. This is classical WKB. That is, we predict classical Lorentzian histories that are the integral curves of this S, that is the solutions to the Hamilton-Jacobi relation that the momentum is equal to the gradient of the action. We predict an ensemble of those, right? Because this only specifies the momentum and not the initial position. One for each initial position with this value of the momentum with probabilities that are roughly the square of the wave function, that is e to the minus 2IR. But there's a condition for the WKB to work in ordinary quantum mechanics, which is that the imaginary part of the action has to vary quickly compared to the real part. Right? Otherwise, you don't get this story. That can be demonstrated easily in quantum mechanics. So we get these classical histories with these probabilities only in a regime where the gradient, where the variation of the imaginary part of the action is large compared to the real part. If we're interested in bouncing universes that come down like this, that might be predicted in such a theory, that condition won't be satisfied near the bounce, simply because near the bounce, everything is varying slowly, including the action. So we won't get classical spacetimes, right? That we won't have this nice classical picture. We'll only have two halves of it, right, connected by quantum transitions. And here's an actual calculation of the transition. I added a parameterized time so as I could solve the dPsiDt equals the Wheeler-DeWitt operator here. Very much like this, we start off with a wave packet that has one classical spacetime, It comes down, classicality ceases, it makes a quantum transition across the bridge into probabilities for different classical space-time on the other side. So there you have it, an example of how classical space-time breaks down, right, in a region, and how you make a transition between a quantum region and a classical region.
Can you say what the scale? So how far, how much time before the bounds you start to lose classicality?
Well, so I had this on the other page. So it depends on what your criteria is for this being satisfied. So it's certainly calculable. I can't display it here.
But is it h to the minus one, or
where h is the Hubble constant, or the
well, whatever, right? You're doing something like
Something like that, right?
So, okay,
that's the scale.
Yeah,
okay.
It's the scale of the bounds, right? I mean, so it's roughly the width. Here's the same picture. I only show it because it won some prize in the one issue of the Physical Review for the best looking picture. But it's one space-time branching into a bunch of them. Okay, that's the first example. The second one is false vacuum bubble nucleation. Suppose we have Einstein gravity coupled again to a single scalar field, right? And we're given the Hamiltonian with a potential that looks like this. It has a false vacuum here, right? And it has two minima, A and B, true vacua. And these two vacua might have different properties. For example, they might have different cosmological constant, different curvature at the bottom, meaning different expressions for the C and B. So the quantum state in general will imply that we start up here in the false vacuum, and then the histories of geometry, if you tunnel out this way, we'll roll down to this, roll down, tunnel through this way, roll down to that. And those correspond to this is the false vacuum, they correspond to the nucleation of bubbles in of type A or type B, observationally distinguishable by CNB observations, and different slow row regimes also, right, that give rise to the difference in the fluctuations. So you, as an observer, are either in this or in this with a certain probability, which you can calculate. So again, if we look at this in a very fine-grained description where we keep track of the whole space-time, there's our Hubble volume, we're in one, but the grand structure of the universe on the very largest scale consists of an infinite number of Hubble volumes in an infinite number of reheating surfaces inside one infinite number of receding inside of an infinite number of bubbles. So it's a very complex structure on large scales, and the space-time corresponding space-time is, again, very complex. But we're not interested in that. We're interested in coarse gratings that define our local observations. Our observations are restricted to one Hubble volume. So we can, if we like, as in the barrier penetration model, coarse grain out everything that we're not following. In particular, just follow one bubble of each kind, whether in A and B. This assumes that the collision rate is low, not by summing fine-grained probabilities, computing the large-scale structure, and then summing over probabilities for everything except one, but by taking advantages of the principles of quantum mechanics, which allow you to coarse grain that way, of course, by summing probabilities, but much more easily by summing the amplitudes and then squaring. Right? Then there are only two histories, one of which is bubble nucleated somewhere in the false vacuum A and B. If we assume that's the Sitter space, a lot of symmetries, it doesn't make any difference where it is. These are the same, and so we just have to calculate these probabilities. And there's a very interesting paper by Hawking and Hertog, right, on what this approach to eternal inflation means. Fuzzballs. Fuzzballs are an example of a mechanism for the breakdown of classical space-time by wave packet spreading. If we go back to all these examples, issue here, we see that the key thing here was that the wave packets spread into two wave packets, defeating classically. One wave packet spread into many wave packets. Well, one wave packet here spread into two wave wave packets. Speak about these. So it depends on what coarse grain, how coarse grained you're looking at the observations. So fuzzballs are an example, as I understand them, which is not very deeply, as an example of a mechanism for the breakdown of classical spacetime in a similar way by wave packet spreading. Here's what I understand of the fuzzball story. Luckily, we have a great expert here who will correct me if I'm wrong. So initially, we have a wave packet that is peaked around a classical collapse solution, say of a spherical shell, right, of mass m and angular momentum j. That wave function, I think the key in the fuzzball picture, is when the radius of that shell gets approximately equal to its mass, the wave function spreads by quantum tunneling over different fuzzball solutions with the same m and j, of course, for their concern, but possibly with different higher order multiples, right, of which I've just denoted here by one number, q, say the quadrupole moment. The tunneling rate is small, but it's compensated for the large number of solutions that it can tunnel into. Most of the subsequent results depend just on this spreading, not on the string theory, the details of the microstates, and so forth. So what does this have to say about observations? Well, it depends on what coarse graining you're going to look at. If you look at coarse grain observations far out, right, suppose you see a collapse somewhere in the sky, and you have enough information to probe only the distance scale that is far out from the center of the collapse, probes by light rays, extreme mass ratio in spirals, and even by observers that might be falling into the black holes, although they probably aren't going to communicate results. There, I think the story is that what you see is indistinguishable from an ordinary general relativistic collapse characterized by whatever the mass is and the momentum is. Finer grain observations that probe further in might measure the value, say, of another multiple moment. The values you see are not an average over the ensemble of possible values, any more than if you measured the position of the one particle. There's still only one particle here, right, in these two wave packets. You wouldn't get an average of the result, meaning it would be in the middle, right? You get one or the other. So the fine-grained observations give you, say, one value of the quadrupole moment, not as an average, but as one or the other of them. In principle, if you made both of these observations and you had the quadrupole moment and you had a formula for the quadrupole moment, like in general relativity, you could distinguish, right, fuzzballs, right, from regular black holes if the formula for the quadrupole moment was different from what it is, say, in the Kerr geometry. Fine-grained observations of many different collapses could verify the probabilities that if the initial M and J were understood, right, verify the probabilities that you would calculate from the wave function of such a collapse for which one occurs. The fuzzball picture suggests a novel way of looking at gravitational radiation. If the quadrupole moment Q changes in the course of tunneling between one fuzzball state and another, which apparently is going all on all the time inside the fuzzball, then if it takes a time t for the tunneling to occur, we would expect, because the quadrupole moment has changed in a time t, we'd expect to get gravitational radiation. I've been unable to see exactly how to calculate that, but here is one calculation. Start with a quadrupole moment, right, which is g over c to the fifth times the third time derivative of the quadrupole moment squared. That's the total luminosity and gravitational radiation and the weak field approximation. So in this case, it would be the change in the quadrupole moment divided by t cubed squared, multiplied by t if we want the total energy that comes out. I didn't know what scale to take, right, for all these, so I just took the mass, Thomas and I, of the system, and the radius, and I took the radius to be equal to mass. So the change in the quadrupole moment is some number times mr squared, the time, we expect it to be some fraction of the light travel time, as here and here. That means the energy you get out in the gravitational radiation is a significant fraction of mc squared. That's a lot of radiation. In the initial LIGO event, this number was about 1/20.
Sorry, this is not at the merger. This is just a generic black hole, isolated black hole should be emitting this at any time.
Well, I'm thinking this tunneling mechanism is taking place inside what we used to call a black hole. It's not a black hole in the sense.
Right. It's the fuzzball, right? But it's an isolated one, isn't it?
Yes. I'm assuming it's isolated.
So you're saying an isolated fuzzball should be just keeps emitting gravitational waves.
Well, so there's a collapse, right? And as I understand it, the wave packet, the wave function spreads by tunneling. And inside, it, you know, it, inside if we could describe it, there would be tunneling from one.
But at some point, it should just stop emitting gravitational waves because it cannot keep doing that, right?
No, well, it's probably how it's addressed, right? The quadrupole formula assumes coherence.
Right.
So I think it's probably suppressed just in the way that the sun is emitting.
Maybe.
You imagine that there's
a I've only
horizon,
got one.
So it suppresses that.
No horizon. We don't want horizon.
Yes, but the same, what Vitor is describing, you can effectively describe as if there is a horizon and there is a big suppression in the coupling between this quadrupole and the one that comes out.
I don't know anything about fuzzballs, but I'm just suggesting if you've got a situation where the quadrupole moment changes in some time, you might look to see whether you got gravitational radiation out.
Yes, but you were assuming that there's no suppression, that the quadrupole goes into external radiation with the same strengths as in the Einstein quadrupole form.
Yeah. And what else could you do, right?
Yeah, but in this case, you might expect some large suppression.
So that factor e to q is probably small.
Right.
Very small.
Bad luck. Right there.
No, it's good because I don't.
John. Wait a minute. Let me finish. I've only got one more slide, and then you can ask all the questions. So people often ask, you know, where and when does classical space-time break down? It doesn't have to be at the Planck scale, right? It can break down just from the distribution of wave packets and their behavior and tunneling. In quantum gravity, the question is not that really. It's why and where we have classical space-time at all, because it isn't a given. You have to calculate. The answer is in whatever you take for the quantum state. Thank you. Yeah, so if you have, suppose you have a spin, right, and it goes through a barrier with a magnetic field, right, and the spin will flip and you'll get electromagnetic radiation. Same argument. Suppression or no, I don't know. Other questions? Oh, good, thank you.
I think Joseph had a question.
No, it was more like a comment. I mean, you know, in principle, when you have a non-extremal black hole, it's very hard for it to have big dipole moments. Supersymmetric microstates fuzzballs have big, you know, they look like cucumbers. But when the black hole is non-extremal, then you know there's a lot of pressure, and you know it will look very round. So you know, in principle, one can actually take your calculation and you know flip it on its back, and say this is an argument which actually constrains the dipole moment, and so on. On the other hand, you know, I think there's something about that which is, you know, if you have Kerr solutions, for example, which spin, then it's possible that all the microstates will have some particular dipole, quadrupole, octopole distributions, which are going to be generic, and you know, that's something which, you know, in principle may give different gravity wave patterns, but it would be only at formations.
Steve. In your bouncing universe example, if you put in some kind of physical clock, an inflaton or something, do you still get a breakdown of the clock?
This example actually put in a...
The chi was the physical, was the field, right?
Put in an inflaton, for example.
To do the calculation, I did what's called parameterize the theory. So I parameterized the time coordinate. Mm-hmm. Right, in a general relativistic thing to make it look like an ideal clock. Mm-hmm. That's this time, that's what this time t is. So if you put in more realistic clocks, right, then you should get physically more realistic answers, but I wouldn't expect them to deviate from a lot from that. So the time here, you know, goes up, then the classicality breaks down, but the clock is still there and comes out on the other side.
You're saying just going through a minimum of radius or whatever.
Well,
needs to break down.
What is a clock in the first place? It's a clock is a device for keeping track of the time directions in a classical spacetime.
Yeah.
If your classical spacetime breaks down, as I'm suggesting here, then you'll have their clock, but it's not keeping track of anything, but it will get to the other side. Does that answer the question? No. Maybe.
Not sure. You know, you could have explicitly, you know, what plays the role of a clock in inflation? The inflaton does. You know,
okay.
Slowly rolling into, you know, it's a scalar field, et cetera. And, you know, I presume you could choose boundary conditions. I'd have to think about it, where you could have set up an inflaton, you know, roll
sure,
you go through the minimum, then you come out the other side.
Right. You put in an extra scalar field for the inflaton.
Yeah.
This does have the scalar field in it. We're keeping track of.
But the boundary conditions and the scalar field are different.
Well, you need to choose the right initial data, et cetera.
Well, that depends on the wave function.
But, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He does this for the boundary. But
for no boundaries.
Exactly.
Okay,
right.
Yeah. So there may be another one where it works. Okay.
That's right.
But this is, you know, that at the turning point, WKB doesn't work.
Right.
If you just take, so this is a very similar example. It's completely standard.
No, I think with a clock, it's not a turning point. It's just classical evolution sails straight through.
If you destroy the turning point, then you will not have a breakdown of semi-classicality, but you can have
Still the classical space, it's what I said before, still the classical space-time is broken down. Right, you may have a clock that goes through, right, some mechanical system, but there's no classical space-time for it to be correlated with.
We can continue this in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Speaker.
How did I do on time?